We use the chalice as a symbol in the Unitarian Universalist tradition to remind ourselves to illuminate our own souls and those around us to bring out the best in each other. All across the country, this happens every Sunday when we remember to do it. Calling all to worship. This is the function that is either an invocation of the Spirit to join us in this space at this time, or an invitation for us to wholly arrive in this space at this time. And that's what the call to worship is. It is you and you and you and each one of us bringing into this space our exhaustion, our joy, our anger, our hostility, our fatigue, our youth, our age. And we all come together, meeting each other together in a space to worship, to make sense and worth of our lives together. Come, let us worship. Have a seat and brace yourselves. Happy New Year, 5778. We have entered this year and the calendar. The shofar is an important part of the New Year practices in the Jewish traditions. This is a genuine shofar, kosher and everything, with a tiny, tiny embouchure, very hard to play. This is a less kosher shofar, the horn of a gemsbok, into which I personally placed an embouchure that smells like a wet dog on fire. We sound the shofar as the book of life is opened. Our lives for the next year have been written in this story. They are written for the next year, but the book's still open. You might say the ink's not dry yet. And for the days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we get to reflect on how we've been and how we can be in ways that could change that story for the future. So next Sunday, the book gets closed with the same horn, or that one. That was revolting. Please read with me what is in here, and then I'll try to use the kosher one to close this reading. May my heart and mind be open to what this time may ask of me. May I be prepared to speak with my mind and with my heart. Ooh, I taste like wet dog. It's meant to pierce the heart and open you to what you just said. Carry on.
I share this story. Well, that's loud. I share this story with permission from my son. He had tears streaming down his face. Mama, you ripped my wubby? Exasperated, I tried to explain to him for the 15th time. I was talking way too fast, but I replied, yes, buddy, I did. But I told you, I was trying to help you. Look, you can rub it between your fingers the way that you like to. I was trying to help you. And he yelled at me. No, Mama, you mean, you ripped my wubby. And then in his loudest voice, he unleashed on me. I'm so very mad at you. And he ran away. I won't lie, I was angry. I'm going to the living room, I said, and when you can stop screaming at me, then you can come talk to me. Which was not the best way to handle the situation. But I walked out. He was crying, I was crying, it was a big mess. I was over the end of the line. My two kids had been on fire lately, and by on fire, I mean they were fighting and melting down and fighting and then breaking something and then fighting again and then melting down. And it was a hard couple of days in my house. They were learning a new routine, and it upended their center of security, so they were really acting out. And you know, my brain, it knew all of this. My training in child development, it informed me. It said, Colleen, slow down. Calm down. You need to be a calm presence for your children. Give them some tools to help them get through this transition. But then my ego whispered in my ear, You're the adult here. You got this covered. You're doing fine. The thing is, though, I needed to show that compassion and calm to bring us back from the edge, and I wasn't. I wasn't breaking out of my why do they hate me pity party, and I couldn't be sure I was going to anytime soon either. I needed to stop walking aimlessly about the house and calm down. I breathed in and out, in and out. But then I had no time to keep doing that because baby sister had joined us into Sad Town at that point, and everyone was freaking out. We were in the weeds. We had come to this hysteria because I had ripped the wubby. There were two wubbies in our house. They were his loveys that he sleeps with at night. They're identical gray pillowcases. One was split down the seam, like this one, and it was the best of the two wubbies. One was not. It was our backup wubby, and it stayed high in the closet for emergencies only. And as we approached bedtime, I could not find the right wubby, and things were starting to go downhill fast. So in a desperate attempt to calm everybody quickly, I took the backup wubby from the closet, and I split the seam in an effort to make it just like he wanted it. I thought it was a great idea. I thought it was more than a great idea. I was pretty sure I'd actually entered a genius level of parenting at that point. He did not. He saw me ripping and maiming his backup wubby, and he unleashed a hurricane on me. So after 30 minutes of every single second chaos, crying, sweating, I gathered us all up, said, "I quit, we're going to bed." I hit the lights, closed the curtains, turned on the fans, tucked them in as they both continued to fidget and whimper, and in a desperate attempt to keep our bedtime routine semi-normal, I made the mistake of saying, "What was your favorite part today?" "I have no favorite part, Mama. I don't want you to say my blessing. Go away." And that's when I was struck. That's when my heart fell. I felt like a failure, and as I nursed his baby sister to sleep, he just stared right through me, tears welling up in his eyes and mine. Tears that I could not keep at bay, because it really stings when you realize how deeply you failed in the moment. I tried to hide them, but he heard my sadness, he felt my sadness, and he inched a little bit closer, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and his chin came up around to look at my face. "Mama, you crying? My favorite part is when I played with the Legos." Mercy. My four-year-old had showed me mercy. Then, quietly and so softly, his chin trembled and tears kept coming, and he said, "Mama, you ripped my wubby?" And a lump rose in my throat, and it almost was impossible to speak because I knew at that point what I needed to do. I needed to see his hurt feelings. I needed to tell him that I was sorry, and I needed to mean it. And so I did. I said, "Baby, I am so sorry that I ripped your wubby. I'm so sorry. Mama was wrong. I was wrong to do that." And he thought about it for a minute. And he looked into my eyes, and his body relaxed, and he said, "It's okay, Mama. It's okay. You want to lay with me?" And I did. I did want to lay with him, and so I did. And I cuddled my boy, and I told him that I loved him, and I told him once again that I was sorry. And his body relaxed, and my body relaxed, and we went to sleep. So sometimes we mess up. I think I'm a pretty good mom, but I mess up all the time, and my adult self says that I should explain and rationalize and qualify and repeat and try to drive home all of my reasons, but none of that will work. No, it won't. Not for a four-year-old, it won't. My child, it seems, just wanted to stop and have me acknowledge his pain, and then he deserved that apology. So when we come to it as adults, understanding and genuinely apologize to our children, without explanation, grandstanding, and qualifying, then we cultivate a chance for our children to feel heard, understood, believed, validated, and valued. And that's what we all need, right?
Did you notice that we changed that section? That singing is now titled Blessing One Another. We sing that in the second service when there very often are no children. We're not singing anyone out. We're sort of singing blessings to ourselves. And I think that's worth pointing out. We do come together in community, sometimes with a great deal of pain or sorrow or anger or loss, sometimes with a great deal of joy and celebration, sometimes forgetting that there is good in the world, and sometimes forgetting that we're not alone. There was an accident this morning on my way to church that looked like one of those horrible things where everything went wrong for everybody. Turns out everybody's okay, including the dog that almost got hit. But the cars hit each other, and nobody really cares about that once they calm down, because no people were hurt, no animals were hurt, and some body shop somewhere gets a little business. And it's okay. Even in those traumatic moments, there's always evidence that something is going to get better. Something is going to get better. There is a town in Turkey, in eastern Turkey, Kocorakan. It's about the size of Kent. It's 28,000 people. And for about 70 years, the restaurants in town have served free meals to those in need every single day. They reserve tables. Even during rush hour, there in the restaurant that started this, there are three tables reserved for people who can't afford to pay for their food. And they get to come eat and be treated just like everyone else. It's been going on for decades, and it's a blessing on the world. And my own joyful experience yesterday was spending most of the day at the Cleveland Museum of Art for no charge at all. You can go stand closer than Van Gogh did when he was painting to the ferocious and fierce, frantic brushstrokes. You can get up close to the Syrah in the tiny, tiny points in the tiny, tiny picture, and so on. And that's a true blessing in the world. And there are good things happening every day. Nobody was inclined to offer yellow cards today, but I would share these good news items regardless. And now I invite us into some shared silence to consider the good and the bad and our part in it. Let there be peace within our hearts, at least between every beat, if not with every beat. Let there be appreciation in our souls with everyone we meet, every sight we see, every day we awaken. May we be filled with appreciation. May there be thoughtfulness in our minds as we realize that even like the best moms, we make mistakes all the time, and that's part of being human. And let's try to carry a well of forgiveness for ourselves and each other. And by coming together in community, by reaching out to the spirit in which we live and move and breathe, may that well never run dry. Amen.
Jesus, how good he is, the love of
Never heard that version before. It was moving, but the sounds of our life have such an effect on us. The sound of the ram's horn is sharp and piercing. It is like none other, although it bears a certain resemblance to bagpipes, I suppose, except just one pipe. A very skilled player can get three different notes out of a well-made shofar, and it's really, really annoying to listen to them do it. But it is meant to pierce the armor of the heart, to let us be vulnerable, to let us be open to change, which is such a difficult task for humans. All this season, the sound of the shofar echoes as it has today. Where it is heard in the heart, it calls a quiet moment out from our busy day. Where it is heard in the mind, it calls us to pay attention. Where it is heard in the spirit, it beseeches us to return to ourselves, slow down, and turn inward. Become at one with ourselves. According to the legends on Rosh Hashanah, the new year, the angel of life writes each of our destinies for the year to come. That has been done. But during the 10 days following that, the days of awe, the book of life is kept open. Your page is right there. If we, during that time, merely try to understand how to take the Torah's insights or any insights we can garner with us into the everyday world, then the angel of life must reconsider what has been written. By just stopping and taking a thought, we make changes that alter the future. Next week, on the last day of the High Holy Days, the shofar will sound on Yom Kippur, says the legend, and the book of life for the year will become sealed. All is written, our fate is sealed for a year, which is kind of cool because you get to hit that reset button over and over again. But we are called to review how we have lived our lives in the year past, right now. All vows, this is a little intense, all vows, all promises we have made to ourselves in this last year, all commitments to unswerving thought, opinion, and behavior are now canceled, nullified, and made naught. Now we are free to re-examine all of our motivations and desires and all the roads we have chosen to walk without critique, because all vows, promises we have made to ourselves, commitments to unswerving thought or opinion, are now canceled, nullified, and made naught. And that's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's a tough part. The claim that we can cancel and nullify all of these things is not to be taken literally. It's meant to crack your heart open and allow you to think something new, to have a new thought. What if I did this year differently than the last? What if I interpreted my own vows and promises more clearly this year than I did last? What if I could become a better version of who I am? The deeper task, which we'll get to at the end, is to forgive and be forgiven of everything by everybody to everybody. Such a universalist thing. But on Yom Kippur, we are called to look at how we may live our lives in the year to come. We can't really alter our course when we are carrying tons of baggage with us. Therefore, this notion of nullifying and clearing the decks and reconsidering, you are not in real life actually free of your obligations, your promises, your vows. But during this special time, these days of awe, there is a bigger power at play if we allow that. We give ourselves freedom to choose to be human beings, even in this world where it often seems as if no one behaves as a human being. On these days between, the spirit of this time calls us to look at ourselves from a place different from the usual vantage point, to see ourselves without the trappings which may clutter our days and ways, to see ourselves as we truly are. It is awesome to look clearly at the real moment. Thus, the days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are called the days of awe. This is what awesome really is. Don't forget to be awesome, so one little card says. Remember this line, I stand in awe of the universe within me as I do of the universe around me. There's a surrender in the days of awe to being part of a much bigger thing than your own worries and cares and opinions and feelings. It's a much bigger thing. It is the act of being human. So we bless this moment by asking the questions asked by Rabbi Hillel. Simply, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? But if I am only for myself, what am I? If I am not for myself, who will be? But if I am only for myself, what am I? The great Maimonides, a 12th century Jewish philosopher, rabbinic scholar from Spain, wrote The Guide for the Perplexed in the year 1190. I think I would have bought that and read The Guide for the Perplexed. But he attempted to reconcile the Talmudic scripture with the philosophy of Aristotle. So put these together, which is a very you thing to do. Let's take some heart and head and try to put them together. Okay? He said that belief in an external image of the divine is idolatry. What we know as holy, we know as an inner force within ourselves. We created outer images of gods, of history, of our stories to understand ourselves and what is in store for us. But what we know as holy, we know as an inner force within ourselves. I stand in awe before my own destiny as I do before the vastness of time. Got that? I stand in awe before my own destiny as I do before the vastness of time. I believe I'm not driving this ship, right? The starting place is within. While there is yet time before the last shofar blow on Yom Kippur, before the angel seals the book of life, the sages tell us that we have the means to change our destinies. So this is what we are to do right now. Our next year is written, but can be rewritten in better ways if we reflect and commit to better ways of being by the time Yom Kippur arrives. The shofar does sound again, and the book gently closes. It isn't often clear what better means, how to be better, what would be better. But it most certainly means different. It means change. And sometimes that means the armor-piercing blow of a shofar to help you be vulnerable and open to change. Now, I didn't grow up Jewish. My ability to convey teachings in a rabbinic style is limited. I thank others of that tradition for writing most of what I just shared. Personally, I turned to the Jewish filmmaker Albert Brooks for help. In the 1991 film Defending Your Life, he directs his own character who, as Albert Brooks would, sardonically dies in the first few minutes, only to instantly arrive in Judgment City, a big business-type model of where you go after you die. But there, just as the title says, he must defend his life. Well, the stakes are very high but somewhat vague. And what there is to defend isn't clear at all at first. His defender, played by Rip Torn, shows brief clips of his life to demonstrate commendable traits to the judges. The prosecutor shows clips as well and interprets them differently. The consequences are more clear than the basis for judgment. You see, if someone is judged ready, then they move on. We don't know what that is. It doesn't say there's a heaven. This is a Jewish thing. They don't have that thing. They just move on. But if you are judged not ready, you come back here to hell. There's no hell in the story. There's only doing this over again, repeating ourselves, repeating, repeating, repeating. If someone gets to move on, we just think it's generally a good thing. But this notion, this you either move on or you come back, is strikingly compatible with universalism. There isn't going to be a hell. We got that. We don't have that hell. Although, we have the ability to make our life on earth hellish, and we often do. All of us do to some extent. Some of us do all the time. Well, eventually, in the film, we learn that everything is about fear. All of it is about fear. What we're being judged on is whether we were afraid or not. On the 25th anniversary of this film, just last year, Brooks reflected that the movie is not about life or death or earth. I think it was about trying not to be afraid. And he supposes that what the movie is saying is going to stay relevant for a long, long time, because fear isn't going to go away. In many stories and in many religions, there is some judgment of good and evil that determines what happens when we finish this life. There's often a chance to adjust your fate or have your fate adjusted in these stories, and the days of awe provide that as an annual obligation to participate in your fate. Not a New Year's resolution along with party hats and excesses, but a serious, awesome reflection on your life. While refreshing myself on the Albert Brooks movie, I stumbled on a blog of the same name, Defending Your Life, launched 11 months ago by a young couple in Detroit and their friend when one of them was diagnosed with advanced kidney cancer. I'll say they caught it in time, but not the cancer. The young man died 46 days after they launched the website. What they caught, these 30-somethings, was the awareness that a life well lived is full of risk and courage and the generosity to always go beyond yourself and think bigger, and as the young widow writes, to connect and contribute. She writes that ultimately, defending your life is here to encourage others to live in a life of courageousness. Its underlying mission is to promote the philosophy that life always presents us with a choice, whether in our smallest moments or biggest decisions, and that we have the continuous opportunity to embrace the vulnerability required to live an authentic life. Always a choice in the smallest moments and the biggest decisions. And here we are with that opportunity. You've heard me enough. It wouldn't surprise you to say that I just think we should make a poem of our lives. And I hinted at that reason a couple of weeks ago. I shared one line from an Adrienne Rich poem. It's in her earth-shattering book, Dream of a Common Language. And the whole poem is quite long, but it's called A Cartography of Silence. I shared the line that says, a poem can begin with a lie and be torn up. A conversation has other laws, recharges itself with its own false energy. And here's why this matters. Although she was a fierce and powerful poet, she's noting right there that a poem is just a poem, And if it's false, if it's a lie, you can just tear it up and try again. The complete first verse helps explain. A conversation begins with a lie, and each speaker of the so-called common language feels the ice flow split, the drift apart, as if powerless, as if up against a force of nature. A poem can begin with a lie and be torn up. A conversation has other laws, recharges itself with its own false energy, cannot be torn up, infiltrates our blood, repeats itself, inscribes with its unreturning stylus the isolation it denies. All right, the second verse, too. The classic music station, playing hour upon hour in the apartment, the picking up and picking up, and again picking up the telephone, the syllables uttering the old script over and over, the loneliness of the liar living in the formal network of the lie, twisting the dials to drown the terror beneath the unsaid word. And I think of the dysfunction in our nation, and I think of how we all get trapped in the wrong conversation sometimes. But while we're at it, the next two are the shortest two verses. There are eight. I'm not doing them all. The technology of science, the rituals, the etiquette, the blurring of terms, silence, not absence of words or music or even raw sounds, silence can be a plan rigorously executed, the blueprint to a life. It is a presence. It has a history, a form. Do not confuse it with any kind of absence. How calm, how inoffensive these words begin to seem to me, though begun in grief and anger. Can I break through this film of the abstract without wounding myself or you? There's enough pain here. This is why the classical or jazz music station plays, to give a ground of meaning to our pain. And here we are. A year passed with its grief and anger, its wounds and pain, its absence of presence. And naturally, there was goodness of many kinds in the year. And every week, I seek the goodness, and that sustains me, reminds me that this is a big world, and there is a lot to it. And it's best not to watch the news all the time, or we sink into despair and cynicism. The conversation of the news is a lie, and it infiltrates our blood and makes us wounded. During this week, we're not asked to reflect on our joys and successes. We are asked to note our failures, our errors, our mistakes, and our shortcomings. We are asked to remember that the book is still open, and we can and must revise our lives. Yom Kippur is technically next Friday, but you know how we are. We'll make it Sunday. We have until then, and on that day we will understand what to do with our study of our life. It's not about specific hopes or plans or goals. It's not about resolutions. This is about sorting out our truths and lies and choosing what to do with that sorting. There is, in effect, no right or wrong. It is entirely up to us. Again, a very you burden we place upon ourselves. No one can tell us the right decision. In the movie, and I will partially reveal the ending here, we learn that it's all about trying not to be afraid. If not for a choice he makes at the very end, Albert Brooks' character would have been sent back to Earth to try again. This was not a cheery thought within the entire arc of the dark comedy. What changes for us for the better, what changes us for the better, isn't just thoughts or beliefs. There must be actions that live into new possibilities. There was one choice his character made at the end that changed everything. So stand by, the ink is not yet dry on your page of the Book of Life. welcome to 5778. Happy New Year. But it's not a blunt entry. We have this shadowy period between the arrival of the year and the full arrival of the year. We have some days left to chart a course. Our universalist teaching does not provide a hellish destination, and neither does Judaism. It's our human choices that determine whether life feels hellish in the meantime. I can't tell you what to do with those choices, but I can't understand why we would mindfully create hell on earth. I cannot understand that. At the heart of it all, whether universalist or Jewish, God is love, and that may be where we can get the courage to be unafraid and keep learning and growing. If God is love, can't we try to echo that, manifest that, absorb that, spread that around? Can't we? I pray that we may have abundant truth, courage, and love in our lives in the coming year. And with that, until Yom Kippur, I say a conditional amen. Before we read together this lengthier than usual reading, I want us each to pause, as I have paused, to reflect on harm and forgiveness. There's been a lot of it in my life this year, and I've inflicted some harm unintentionally. I've hurt some feelings. I raised my voice in an inappropriate way once, and I'm not asking for penance as I would have as a Catholic. I'm simply noting that I did these things. I did these things. And people have done things to me. I told you a significant and deeply harmful story that happened to me by a friend who we eventually reconciled this year, because forgiveness comes from within. And sometimes harm comes from within. Nothing really happened to make us feel harmed, but we fear that we are harmed. It's complicated, which is why we have 10 days to reflect on the nature of harm and forgiveness, and we read the following together. I hereby forgive whomever has hurt me, whomever has done me harm, whether deliberately or by accident, whether by word or by deed. May no one be punished on my account, as I forgive and pardon fully those who have done me wrong. I shall seek out those whom I have harmed and ask them to forgive and pardon me, whether I acted deliberately or by accident, whether by word or by deed. May I not willfully repeat the wrongs I have committed. May justice rule the world, giving joy to the land, happiness to the city, renewed strength and light to the people. And stand by, there are exceptions, so you don't have to forgive certain politicians or bankers. Oh my goodness, I hadn't read those lyrics. But while I reflect on something here, please find hands to hold and try to connect, because it's a big world and we need to hang on lest we fall off. This line, mastery overdrives in us that war pursue. Oh my goodness, is that not what happens when we get absorbed in the news of violence in the world? Don't we take it on for ourselves? Let's not do that. Let's gain mastery over that human frailty that we have to sink to the low levels of life. And as we enter these days of awe, as we are in the midst of them, we don't have to be Jewish. We don't have to come from that tradition. We're looking at ways to be better humans. It's okay to be a humanist. It's okay to be a Christian. It's okay to be a Buddhist and still want to be a better human. Isn't that sort of the point? So we don't do that by blaming others for our mistakes. We don't do that by ignoring everything and thinking that we're just fine. We do that by change. Oh, I'm sighing after every time I say change, because people keep saying change is hard. And as our guest said last week, you think change is hard, try irrelevance. Because if you just sit still, your life is being wasted. So let's reflect with energy, enthusiasm, and with a universal hope for all that is good in our lives, how to be better people in the coming year. There's plenty of joy to spread around. Don't forget that. Go in peace. Thank you, Hal.